My name's Gail Q, and our guest this morning is Serge Ben-Hayen. Serge has been working with energy and energetic healing for the past 10 years. He lives and works here in the Northern Rivers area, although he also conducts regular workshops in the UK and Vietnam. It's been 2 years since Serge graced our airwaves, so I'm keen as you are to get him on an open mic. So please join me in welcoming Serge. Good morning.
Hi, Gail.
It's great to have you here. As always, the topics to cover and the depth of information is a bit daunting, so where to begin? And the beginning for you as a healer is now a decade ago, so I don't think we can start there. We just don't have that much time. But as a courtesy to our listeners who may not be familiar with you or universal medicine, let's give them just a brief introduction. Now, if you are on a plane, which I know you were probably less than 24 hours crossing the ocean there, and someone sitting next to you sincerely asks, oh, what do you do in Australia? What do you say?
I would say that I practice esoteric medicine, and I would tell them what esoteric medicine is, which is the working with energy and anatomy and physiology and understanding the human body on an energetic level. I would tell them to consider that everything is energy, and if everything is energy, everything is because of energy, and therefore, by looking at the energetic root cause of our conditions in the body, we have a great advantage in getting on top of them.
Well, that seems clear and not too confronting, so they might actually be able to hear you on that. Now, one of the things that Des, the regular presenter on this program, always asks his guest is, how did you come to this area? Now, I know you used to be a tennis coach in Sydney. So did you come directly from Sydney to this area?
That's correct. We came straight up. I've always known the area. When you turn 17 and you live in Sydney,
schoolies.
You put the P plate on the Kingswood and you come up and surf at all the beaches, and always the mecca is Byron Bay, and it was back then a sleepy town. So I've always known Byron Bay for quite a long time. And we decided to move our four kids from Sydney to raise them in an environment where we had the time to spend time with them. So we did that in 1992, and we've been here for 17 years, which our number four, our youngest, is 17.
Right. And now I know you in the energetic work for the last 10 years. So if you've been here 17, you must have not been practicing your esoteric healing the first few years you were here. Was there a moment where, kind of an instantaneous moment, where you knew you were a healer? Or did you build up and practice? Or what was going on there?
It was just the simplest way to explain that is to understand that when it was time, the soul makes contact, and you either respond and say yes, or you say no, I'm doing very well, thank you, I'll continue doing what I'm doing. So it was never an instruct, but a very strong impress from a voice within to consider changing what I was doing back then, which was tennis coaching. And it was a love. I had no problem, and I had no intentions of leaving. I loved tennis coaching. So the voice had to be very, very loving for me to even consider leaving tennis coaching, which was my number one passion.
Mm-hmm. And so you obviously responded with the yes. And I think one of the things, I don't know if you know this about yourself, Serge, but a lot of people who maybe can't quite get the work, they're not ready. And so they've got question marks around the work, or they're skeptical, but they never doubt you. They always say, oh, I have no doubt about Serge. He's pure. They can feel your soul coming through, even if they're not ready for the work. So that's the part of you that just shines through in spite of whether they're ready for the work. But I suspect our listeners this morning are ready. Now, it's become quite well known in recent years that you're part of a lineage of the ancient wisdom, which was... So you're like the third transmission. This came through before in Helen Blavatsky and Alice A. Bailey. Do you think there's any relevance to you living in this area when you answered the call?
With the benefit of hindsight, absolutely. I don't think I would have adhered to the call living in Sydney and being very busy as we were running businesses and running around with kids in their activities. So definitely it was all, I could look back and say it was definitely a setup, but I can honestly say I had absolutely no control or vision or knowledge that this would come.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's relevance to it being in Australia versus England or America?
Australia is a young country, and it's very open and fresh to new changes. Australia tends to leave people alone and not put a lot of pressure on them.
True.
We have a good freedom of speech. The religious bodies tend to not have as much power as they do in other countries. And so our ability to communicate how we feel, so to speak, is left to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, universal medicine in the 10 years that I've known of it has grown branches every direction. There's the arcane work, which is also known as the School of Livingness, still at Ewingsdale Hall, amazingly, because it's just packed to the rafters for every event. There's heart chakra workshops, sacred esoteric healing, now the esoteric yoga classes, which I've been doing and loving, esoteric breast massage for women. There's a whole esoteric healing network. Now, all of the people in that you would have had hands-on training with. Is that correct?
Yes, I've personally trained all the practitioners that we now have all over the world with clinics dedicated to esoteric healing. And we have them in Norway, in Holland, in Germany, in England, of course, in Wales, in Australia, in New Zealand, and so forth.
It's And meditation groups and the books. And in fact, while you were in the UK just now, I was in the bookshop last week, and I noticed there's a new book on the shelf. So that must have come out while you were in England.
Yes, it went to print as I boarded the plane, and it was released as I was away. And the next book is actually out next week.
Oh, okay.
So we're releasing two books in the 4-week period.
Uh-huh. All right, well, we'll talk about the books maybe a little bit later on. Well, in fact, what I want to do right now is I want to refer to book 3, which is The Way of the Initiation. And one of the keys in that book to initiation is about the use of language and grammar. So I'd like you to introduce that key now, because it's very important for listeners to have an understanding of the esoteric definition of a few words for us to continue this interview. So before we get to the definitions, I'd like you to just give us the importance of the language that you're using.
The like the modalities that we practice, they always come back to the energetic meaning and the energetic truth, what is going on energetically. The best way to describe the esoteric language is to say that if we have 1,000 different versions of joy, then there'll be some who are truly in joy and others who are not. The ones that are truly are in joy will be experiencing joy, energetically speaking, and those who are not in joy will be calling joy something that's better than suffering.
Uh-huh.
So the book explains the fact that if we need to have expression in the world, that we need to get a one unified understanding of how we speak. Because if somebody's in true joy, we want to know why. If somebody and we can get inspiration and help from them. But if somebody is not in joy and they think they're in joy, they might be missing out on a better and true life. And that's the whole idea of that key of the initiation. Initiation just means becoming energetically aware of life. Looking at the unseen and becoming aware that there is more than the physical eye can see. So that particular chapter is very important because it demonstrates to us that we have lost our responsibility in the way we communicate with words and the way which we write. And we tend to use expletives, for example, to mean a lot of things. But if we don't express what we really want to say, those emotions are still held in the body.
Mm-hmm. And so we might go into some definitions now. I think that just about a comment before we move into definitions. The books from Universal Medicine If you pick them up and try and take a quick read to see if you're going to get into it, you might think, wow, this is written in kind of a weird language or a weird way. But they're energetically configured, as I understand this, to actually enter our brain in a different pathway than a lot of our education and programming in those neural pathways that have gotten to be ruts in there. Is that right?
This is correct. The book appeals to you energetically, so it asks you to feel what is being written, and the construct of the way in which I write is very deliberate and purposeful. The words themselves, if you pick them out, are not difficult. It's not technically difficult. Mm-hmm. But the way in which they are constructed isn't the way we normally read, which asks us to look at one line at a time. This asks us to sit back with the words that we just read in addition to the word that we are about to read. So the book is very alive constantly, and it asks you to not forget the last sentence, but to move on to the next one in no anticipation other than to be with the words as you read them.
Okay, and so a minute ago you said that the book appeals to the reader on how they feel, or which leads us into the first word I would like you to define, which is clairsentience.
Clairsentience is the ability to clearly feel the difference between a feeling and an emotion. Within that, there is also clarity within feelings. But the most important thing is to know the difference between a feeling and an emotion. An emotion is usually the reaction to something we feel. It's personalized and it's reinterpreted, and it becomes a very personal experience of something we have felt. That's what we call that's what the true energetic meaning of an emotion. A feeling is something you just feel, and it is as pure as it is. If you can feel someone's anger, then that's a feeling. If you react to someone's anger and personalize it and believe they're angry at you or angry at someone else, and you start to consider what the consequences may be, then you have left the feeling and you've gone into emotion. This is important.
Mm-hmm. And so a feeling is like a knowing, like you just know that this is a truth.
It's instant and it's very easy, and it needs not to be overrided by the brain.
Uh-huh. And is that available to every one of us?
Every single one of us is equally clairsentient. What we lose is our awareness to the fact as we grow up, and we're not met by society. We're not asked to be who we are. We are always told to be something. So we always have these constructs in our minds about trying to be something instead of just being. But if we return to that simplicity, which our gentle breath meditation begins, the journey, we can also reacquaint ourselves with the fact that we've never ever stopped feeling energy.
Mm-hmm. But it gets programmed out of us as very small children. And then one time I heard you talking about when we go to school, we still have some residue of that feeling, that knowing, and yet we're told to cut that off and look forward, pay attention to the whiteboard or blackboard, it was in my day, in front of us, and narrow our field of knowing. So that's the start of the education process, where we really become disengaged from this knowing. Now, do you reckon this is the most important skill or tool for a student or someone who's really wanting to return to God, walk the path back to God?
If one of the basic teachings that we teach at our baby course, which is Heart Chakra 1, which is on next February, is to actually reacquaint ourselves with feeling energy. If we can do that, then there is nobody that can lie to you, because you can actually feel the energy of dishonesty just as clearly as you can place your hand over a hot stove and pull it away. It's very, very clear.
Mm. And now, I've heard you say this for a number of years, and I've only recently getting a sense of it myself, and it's a wonderful feeling when you get there. So what I'd like to do right now is share just a few words with our listeners, and this is from Serge's third book, and I'd like to read a few words from that as an invitation to you, the listener. With your eyes opened, you may choose what to see, and with your eyes closed, you cannot negate what you feel. Close your eyes and feel the truth. This is the way to the law of correspondence, the law that allows you to feel the essence of any one thing from the truth of your inner heart. So, Serge, let's give the listeners just a few definitions to help with the rest of the interview. I think one of the most useful is to be aware, reminded of the difference between the soul and the spirit.
Yeah, that's a very important definition, especially in Byron Bay.
Yes.
The spiritual New Age Mecca of the world, or one of them. The spiritual journey is about liberating the human being to the possibilities of being a divine design. And one of the closest steps we have to being in divine design is to experience our relationship with the soul. The soul is the made manifest of God in the creation of His image, as some of the books have quoted. And we have forgotten that we separated from that image to have what I would call a wayward life. And that wayward life is experienced by the spirit, having a human experience, a spiritual journey, a spiritual sensorized experience of life. And so it's important that when we talk about spirit and soul, that most understand that there is a huge difference between spirit and soul. One works with the fiery energy of life, and one works with prana or pranic energy.
Okay, great. Well, those are the words I want to talk about next. So tell me if this is correct. Like, when people think about spirit and soul, I think of the soul as being the divine spark, the original impulse from God, and the spirit like a bridge between the personality and the soul. But the spirit has gotten heavily invested in the personality and the pranic energy. Is that a fair summary?
That's spot on.
Okay.
The bridge has become individualized and has taken a life on its own, when really it is supposed to bridge the human being to its divine spark.
Okay, so now let's talk about that fiery energy, the divine energy, and the pranic energy.
Okay, so if we take it very simply, and this includes a wide range of listeners for you this morning, if everything is energy, as Einstein said, and before energy used to be called light, and other great teachers have said everything was light, so we've had that quotation comment around for many thousands of years. But if everything is energy, everything has to be because of energy. Therefore, if we have, for example, cancer or arthritis or diabetes, there has to be an energy that caused that. Now, what we teach in esoteric medicine, or what we know in esoteric medicine, is that the cause of that ailment, whatever that may, illness or disease, has to come from an energy. Now, we can define that energy as being an energy of separation to the soul, which we call prana or pranic energy. Pranic energy is the energy that the spirit uses to individualize itself and have a human experience. Over many, many thousands of years, this has been bastardized, and the clarity between fire and prana has not been clearly understood and therefore not clearly taught. And this brings up a lot of confrontation, because a lot of people call God prana.
Mm-hmm.
Prana is everything, pranic this, pranic that, and they don't realize what they're talking about, because there's a huge difference between fire and prana.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when people are talking about prana in, say, Eastern meditations or yoga or even some of the healing modalities, this is the same pranic energy, just we have a misunderstanding of the origin of that energy.
The misunderstanding isn't just in the spoken word and its definition. The misunderstanding is also energetic, in the sense that in truth they are using the wrong energy. Now, a lot of them don't like to hear that, because they don't want to be exposed as being fooled energetically. And so when they hear me saying that there's a difference between fire and prana, and that prana is actually the cause of all illness and disease, including mental health and so forth, they don't like the confrontation, because they are aiding and abetting, so to speak, the higher use or extra use of pranic energy. But But we need to understand that it is an energetic definition before we can say that it's a communication issue.
Right. And so that statement that you often make that confronts a lot of people about everything you do either heals or harms, this is linked then to it's either fiery energy or it's pranic energy.
If you understand that everything is energy, you either heal with the energy you use to speak, to breathe, to walk, or you harm in the same energy. So it's important to understand that we need to develop clairsentience, which is the feeling that will give us the definition between the two energies. If we rely on the brain, we could talk about it all day, but there'll be just words, regurgitation, knowledge. But the brain is a receiver of energy. It doesn't feel or discern energy. So it's not a question of semantics, as I am sometimes accused of exercising.
Mm-hmm. And is this the first step in free will, choosing either fiery energy or pranic energy?
The very science of free will isn't about making choices, whether you open the fridge door and choose chocolate or not. That's a psychological choice. That's a choice at that moment. Free will is the use of the energy that will conduct you in every way, shape, or form. Once you've chosen the energy that will make you live, so to speak, and give you the life force, thereafter, your consciousness, your mind, the way you think, move, speak, communicate, everything that you do comes from that energy. So the real choice is not after you've made the energetic choice, but before. Free will is about whether you choose to be fiery or pranic.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving along with definitions, with that great background to set us up, something you've probably been talking about for absolutely years, and I'm only hearing it now, meaning the last few years, is self-love. And I think I'm probably not unique in not really having practiced self-love, because that's not part of our culture. We're taught to put others first and not think of ourselves, or, well, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but I suspect it's a cultural upbringing thing. So let's talk about self-love a little bit.
Self-love is the understanding of self in the being. It's understanding that you are gentle by nature, and that gentleness then develops into a loving way of being. And self-love is the development of that bridge between gentleness and love. And we need to develop self-love so that we can eventually get to what we all want, which is love itself. And the way to get to self-love is through gentleness. The three are intertwined. And we need to understand that self-love is something that we need to do before we can truly love another. Mm-hmm. An empty body, energetically, an empty body cannot love. It might think it loves, but it is actually putting needs, the need of another or the need of self. And we have in our language an energetic misinterpretation of what love is, and that is to serve others in their needs. And we call that being loving,
right?
But it's not.
Mm-hmm. Because if we're not coming from a place of self-love, then what we're offering them is less than love. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and in some circumstances we can say that if somebody is very, very empty of love and very empty of self-love, then it's impossible from an energetic point of view, from a scientific point of view, that they can actually offer love.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not in their body energetically. It's not flowing. It's not, the body's not living it. They don't truly understand it.
Okay. Now, I do want to have you talk a little moment about gentle breath, but we're not going to do a meditation this morning, but I wanted to let the listeners know there is a free download on Serge's website, which is www.universalmedicine.com.au, and on the left-hand menu there's an audio, and when you go there you'll see there's a free gentle breath meditation which you can download. So we won't do that this morning, but tell us briefly about a gentle breath.
The gentle breath meditation allows us to feel where we are at in any given moment. We are a society that has lost touch with our true rhythms in our body. If most people could connect back to their body, they would understand that they are running on super exhaustion, hence why so many are using coffee and tea and so forth and sugarized drinks to get through. So the gentle breath allows you to feel the fact. It allows you to become honest. That's the wonderful thing about the gentle breath. It develops honesty about self. It allows you to not get surprised later down the track with unfelt ailments that develop into more medical, serious medical conditions. So gentle breath brings us to ourselves. It helps to connect to ourselves and allows that honesty to be there.
Mm-hmm. And just a key component of that meditation is when you instruct us to close our eyes in order to be with ourselves rather than closing our eyes to shut out the world. That just really clarifies what we're doing in that meditation. Now, the thing is that when you first introduced the gentle meditation years ago, we used to do it for an extended period of time, and now the same result can occur in like 5 minutes or less. So I wanted to talk about what was happening in the energetic energy in a more universal way, like heading as we are into 2012, which isn't somewhere out in the future anymore. It's right around the corner. So there seems to be an acceleration of everything, of the and that's why this meditation now can be done in such a shorter period of time. So can you talk about that acceleration and maybe how you see this lead into 2012?
I don't want to sound a little bit too nicey here, but the fact is there's actually more love available to us than ever before. It seems ridiculous in the circumstances we find ourselves in society that the opposite is happening. But curiously, what people are doing is they're rejecting that love because it's not in the body, and so they're finding that they have to go into many more different types of wayward behaviors to support that. But the fact is there's more love, and so the gentle breath meditation today can achieve in 5 minutes what we used to need or require for 10, maximum 15 minutes before when you first heard of it back in 99 and 2000 when I was presenting it then. I've never taught the meditation to be longer than 15 minutes because sitting down to meditate should be a connection. And once you're connected, we should just go about our daily chores, tending to the kids, working and so forth and so forth. Meditation should not be an escape. If meditation is a 1 hour, half an hour, 2 hour, then you're just basically checking out. It's no different to taking drugs. It's the same thing. You're just not coping. So meditation should never be an escape. It should not be a checking out, and it should never be a shutting out of the world. You close your eyes to be with you, and once you can feel you and you connect, then every movement you make thereafter magnifies you. And that's how you get enlightened. It's not about sitting there and meditating until you levitate. And somebody says, wow, look at your levitation. You've enlightened yourself. Enlightenment comes through the distribution of love through the body. And that only comes through service, activity, and daily chores in normal everyday life.
Mm-hmm. So on planet Earth or in a bigger scheme of the cosmos, is the energy changing around us that's supporting that return to love or moving back towards the Godhead?
There's been some significant changes in the last 2,500 years. Siddhartha Gautama, which we know as Buddha, made it possible for us to have God directly to us. That was a very personal experience, but it was somewhat transcendental in the sense that we had to transcend ourselves to and from. Then Jesus came along, and inspired by the Christ, he showed us that not only can we have that, but we can have it embodied in everyday life. And he and his wife and his three daughters were able to communicate that in family, community, everyday living as a normal human being. And that you didn't have to go out solo, leave your family behind like Siddhartha Gautama did, to find it. Well, since then, the second coming of the Christ has made that possible for everybody. So all that's happened in 2000 when the second coming arrived is another great drop of that same love that Jesus spoke about. And that love is increasing from 2000, and it will peak at 2012 when what we call the end of time comes. Now, the end of time is really the beginning of the end of the pranic way of life. It's not going to be any abruption. There's not going to be any Armageddon in the sense of destruction and so forth. We've already got an enormous amount of earthquakes and tsunamis in the last 10 years as a necessary correction by Mother Earth as a result of our wayward ways. But all of that is a positive in the sense that it's making way by way of clearing old energy for us to understand that it is eventually going to be all about love, not technology.
Our guest this morning on Colors of Byron is Serge Ben-Hayen from Universal Medicine. And what I'd like to talk about in this next segment of the interview is the sacred esoteric healing workshops. Because all of the different branches I mentioned earlier on in the interview have very different focuses. You refer to the heart chakra workshops as the baby course, meaning that it's not about bringing your baby, although they do. It's an introduction to energy and energy everywhere. Now, the sacred esoteric healing workshops are much more advanced for people who've probably done the majority of the heart chakras, are really wanting to understand the science of energy and how it works in our body and how to work with that in a healing, almost a medical way. You actually have to understand the body to some degree. I want to talk about those. Now, it's hard to go past the rapid increase in cancer all around the world. So if everything is energy and these diseases are originating with energy, let's look at that. And particularly, I guess I'd like you to speak on breast cancer for women and prostate cancer for men.
Okay. Just getting back yesterday from the UK. The UK is special in the sense that the National Health Services, which is the NHS, they tend to publicly show the figures a little more open than they do in Australia. In England, for example, in 2006 and up to current time, they have 45,600 brand new cases of breast cancer per year.
Wow.
It's astronomical. We walked into a store we had half a day off and went to look at some stores and boutiques, and there was a sign just on the counter when you pay, please give, 125 women per day are being newly diagnosed with breast cancer. That's enormous. That's 45,600 per year, fresh, brand new diagnosis. This isn't. That means that by the time you've had 3 years, you've had 120,000 and 130,000 women who have either undergone surgery or treatment. In addition to that, there is 38,000 per year with lung cancer. I mean, it's enormous. I don't have the prostate cancer figures with me, but cancer is difficult to treat depending on the stages of development that you capture it in. And I want to say that whilst I practice esoteric healing, I'm a number one fan of medicine, conventional medicine. And eventually I hope that esoteric medicine and conventional medicine reunite. They did start together.
Mm-hmm.
Conventional medicine was the one that walked away, and right. they're the ones that became alternative. But one day the doctors will be so exhausted with what's going on in society that they're actually going to stop and say, we don't have the answers anymore. We have a great part of the answer, but we need to have more than this. And it's at that point that the doctor hopefully will look at a responsible way to merge what they do very well already with the growing out of control rates of illness and disease and combine it with a responsible energetic form of healing. We hope to be that responsible entity, so to speak, or corporation.
Well, it's already happening because I talk to doctors and registered nurses and specialists at your workshops, so I know they are starting to, in their practice, get exhausted and go, well, this isn't enough. I've got to do more.
Yeah, we predicted back in 2001 that there would be a series of ailments which we call the multi-symptomatic man. And whereas before we would go to three or two specialists but to get a second opinion, today we need up to five specialists, different specialists, just to get a proper diagnosis of what's going on. And some of the more honest specialists are actually saying, what we're seeing today, we're not trained for at medicine school. We don't really know. We know our part in it, but we don't know the multi symptoms that are also coexisting with the symptom that we're trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very important that the doctors are fantastic, and I'm a number one fan of medicine, but they need to stop and say, we don't have all the answers. And if we can do that, then community will start responding by saying, hey, we're putting an enormous amount of pressure on medicine to cure our illnesses. And if the doctor says he doesn't have all the answers, then it's going to come back to community and say, well, it has to start from the way we're living. We're living in a way that is disharmonious, and that disharmony eventually finds itself as a form of illness or dis-ease in the body. Breast cancer is very easy to avoid, if I may use such a claim, without making it too claimy, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that is very simple. Women have become very hard, very male orientated, in the sense that they are very busy and not listening, and they are simply not nurturing in their bodies. The breasts are the nurturing centers. In esoteric medicine, each organ has a role to play in the body, which in turn makes up a unified divine design. But we live in a way that is separate to that, and we segregate the body and use, for example, the pancreas to drive us to achieve, to climb Mount Everest, to get a PhD and so forth. And we use organs to drive us, but negate other organs at its expense. So women are forgetting that they are nurturing centers, and that they've forgotten how to nurture, and breast cancer is out of control. They're good at nurturing others, but not so good at nurturing themselves.
Oh, a self-love issue, is it?
Correct.
Okay. And what about men with prostate cancer?
That's on the rise as well. From an esoteric point of view, we see that men have responded to what everybody's been asking them to do, and that is to become more gentle and more sensitive. And a man is trying to do that. But it's very difficult when you're told from a very young age that when you roll off your skateboard and open your knee up with a lot of blood, that you help yourself to your own tap and run your knee under the tap. And there isn't anybody that is going to be there to sit you on their lap and cuddle you and hold you and nurse you, as perhaps little girls tend to get. And we learn that as men, and we tend to harden. But we're starting to listen, and we're starting to get sensitive. But when we become sensitive, we become rather pathetic, because we don't know that we are naturally sensitive. And so we get confused between being hard, being the provider, carrying all the weight of the world in our shoulders, and being responsible, with being sensitive. And so men are losing sight about how to be sensitive. And as a result, they have very confusing energies in their body, which is giving the rise to prostate cancer.
Uh-huh.
So in short, it is a man who finds it very difficult to be sensitive in a society that is asking him to be hard. That's prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. And there must be some confusion as well if the women have started running this bigger male energy by holding corporate positions and becoming often the breadwinner in the family. That must contribute to their confusion about what their role is if the woman's holding the male energy.
That's correct. What women should stop and consider very deeply is the fact that, yes, they've won equality, and they should have, because it was heavily sided towards the male, but they've done it at a great expense. They've achieved that through becoming hard, very driven, and very male-orientated in their energy. I don't mean that they don't look feminine and so forth. It's not about that. Just the energy that runs through their body is a very male, motion-driven energy, instead of the lovely stillness they naturally have, which is a very more nurturing energy. And as a result of that, we have the awful figure of 45,600. And if anyone thinks that that's just a figure, as I see all figures as people, if anyone watched the Rugby League Grand Final early, not that long ago, half of that stadium is what is the number of women. If you picture half the Telstra Stadium, that's the 45,600 women that get diagnosed with a fresh new case of breast cancer. It's horrible when we put it into images like that.
Mm-hmm. So if the underlying one of the underlying issues is self-love for women, can you give us a couple of practical examples of how a woman might practice being more self-loving? Is it a bubble bath sort of thing, or?
Yes, I can start by watching Audrey Hepburn movies.
Okay.
Once again, and look, in those movies, although they're not perfect, and I'm not saying they're esoteric in the way of their life, but it was okay for a woman to be late simply because she was brushing her hair longer and couldn't find the dress that she wanted to wear. And these days, the woman is picking the man up, and he's the one too slow in shaving and so forth. So we've got to return to what feels right, what not look at the clock. A woman isn't great at running to a clock. She has a very, very beautiful rhythm in her body. And if all of society could run to that rhythm, we'd all be much better off. So I've been a great supporter of women reconnecting to their stillness, to that loveliness that gives them that rhythm. They have cycles, they have periods, they know the fluctuations of the moon and so forth. And we need to bring that back to the woman so that the man can rebalance himself, because he's out of balance because she's gone into the male energy. And he's trying to be more male to out-male the woman, but at the same time looking for his sensitivity. It's quite crazy, really.
Mm-hmm. And how about for a man then? How would a man demonstrate more self-love for himself? What might be one suggestion?
The man needs to honor himself in fragility and not see that as a sign of weakness and not see that as being pathetic. It's okay to complain, to come home, and for a guy that works in the building site and to say, hey, my boss was really awful to me today. He spoke in a horrible way. And we tend to think that men are strong enough to cope with that, but they're not. Men, all men are very, very sensitive, and that hurts them. And even it even hurts the boss to have to speak like that. But sometimes time schedules allow for that. So guys become very hardened, if we can continue to use the worksite example, about trying to be macho and hard and pretend that nothing hurts. But it's okay to come home and cuddle in someone's shoulder and say, it's really hard at work, everybody's hard, everybody's swearing and carrying on, and there's very really little gentleness there.
Mm-hmm. The one other disease that I wanted to just touch on is diabetes, because this is one that seems like everywhere I turn around, and I bought a new pair of shoes the other day, and there was a brochure actually on the counter about foot care for people with diabetes. So it's just so on the rise now that you can't even buy shoes without being confronted with diabetes. What's going on with diabetes?
I'm glad to see Australia is heading more like England in terms of advertising what's really going on. Diabetes comes from a disharmony in the pancreas. From an esoteric point of view, it comes from our natural ability not being used. So it's a holding back of our natural abilities, and that holding back causes the energy of the pancreas to invert. Once that energy inverts, it causes a disharmony. Medicine then calls the non-reproduction of insulin or the over-reproduction of insulin and so forth. So it's the disharmony in the pancreas that then gives rise to what science can call the medical condition. And that's how we need to think in the future. We need to say, yes, for sure, diabetes is everything that medical science says it is. But before it is any of that, there's an energy that is causing that. And that's the key. That is the one thing that's going to help us recover. Because from my understanding, there's also a large rise in children being diagnosed with diabetes
juvenile,
now. That's juvenile diabetes.
So when you say diabetes, the energy behind that is from, what did you say, not living naturally?
Not living your potential.
Not living your potential.
Yeah, holding back.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's either by having a fear of moving into it or changing courses. Maybe you've gotten too far down the road and it seems too hard to change.
Fear, self-doubt, a lack of confidence, holding back. living in contraction, worrying about what other people think, not wanting to shine, not wanting to stand out. We seem to have to make an excuse for shining these days, and you know, that used to be a natural thing to shine and inspire others, and everybody seemed to be in this. Humility has lost its true meaning, and everybody's trying to not shine to fit in, and as a result, that's the diabetes.
Okay, so be willing to shine out there, people. Our guest this morning is Serge Ben-Hayen. Now, Serge, when I was telling people in the last couple of weeks that I was going to have the privilege of interviewing you on air, they said, oh, I'd love to ask him a question. I said, well, okay, write your question down. So this segment of the interview is actually questions from other people. So they're a bit random because every question's from somebody else. Now, one of the people knew that you were in the UK again this past month, and so they were wondering if you find presenting your work in the UK, do you have to modify it, or do you teach the same thing to the people in the UK as you do in Australia? Are we all across the planet ready to learn the same part of esoteric healing?
Well, if I may say, they're actually more open and more willing in the UK.
In the UK.
And we get them from Germany, Holland, Norway, you know, France, and Portugal, Spain, and so forth. So whilst our base is in the UK and we have a centre there, they come from all over Europe. They know we come twice a year, all of June, all of November, and they make plans in accordance to that schedule. But they are very open, very willing, and probably more so than Australians to go deeper with their issues, and are more willing to deal with them.
Okay.
If well, I may say, that was a surprise. I thought we'd go to the UK and find a more cold, unopened, stereotyped Anglo-Saxon that we're told about, but the English, you know, they're so committed to knowing more. They're ready.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Now, the next questioner, she says, my mother died about 3 years ago. I do believe in reincarnation, and I'm wondering if she might reincarnate in my lifetime. So, two questions. How long in between reincarnations, and where is the soul when it is in between physical incarnations?
The life in between incarnations is held by the spirit, not the soul. The soul is always residing on the soul plane, ever waiting to be earthed by us as a human being. The process of embodying the soul has to come from our humanness, our human way of life, and it's not something the spirit can do in the astral plane. The life lived in between lives is usually 2 to 9 years before somebody reincarnates, unless, of course, they've had a very, very horrific time. They usually come back within 5 to 6 years. So most people do reincarnate in our lifetime. They don't always appear as the little baby next door or the little baby of your daughter and so forth, although sometimes that happens. It's not always wise to come back so close to something, especially if you have undealt with issues. You're given a fresh new family and so forth while you pick your parents. And that's how it happens. The only time that we come back very quick is suicides. They come back within 6 to 12 months, usually 6 months, and they come back in the energy that they left in, very traumatized.
Uh-huh. And do they have more of an inclination to return to the family that they left or not?
Depending on the circumstances, but usually not, because it'll be too overwhelming to be in the same energetic patterns that drove you to do what you did.
Uh-huh. Okay, so on that question about where is the soul in between physical reincarnations, the soul's always residing
in the soul plane.
In the soul plane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Serge. Next question. This questioner says, I have very vivid dreams. Now, do you think it's important to pay attention to my dreams, or are they just an extension of the illusion?
All of the above. There's three types of dreams. There's the personality dream, which is really just the excesses of daily life that are undealt with, unfinished, these are just daily emotions that our organs release at night. Then there's the spiritual kind, which are usually full of illusion, deceit, cunningness, and occasionally hint at a truth. And then there's soulful dreams, which are usually an impress of a truth you need to look at. And this comes back to clairsentience. It comes back to feeling which of those three are the dreams that you are having. But if you're avoiding your issues on a daily basis, and your pattern is to avoid and not deal with your behaviors, and chances are you are usually having spiritual-based dreams, which are of the illusional kind.
And is it useful to look at those and see what they're saying to you?
Yes and no, because if there is, you know, there's influence from the astral plane, and it's usually skew. If you know, it's not really very accurate. And whilst we can draw something from them, it's important not to make too much detail of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Get an overall feeling of the dream and avoid the detail.
Mm-hmm. That's a good dream tip. Just write down the feeling or retain the feeling.
Yeah.
Thanks, Serge. Okay, this questioner says, I'm reading book two, referring to the Universal Medicine books.
A Treatise on Consciousness.
Yes. So around page 259, she says, you, Serge, are talking about the Atlantean consciousness, and it feels a bit like history, which isn't my favorite subject. Do I actually need to understand the past, the historical presentation that you make about Atlanta?
The esoteric language describes root periods where certain forms of consciousness predominated or dominated. So the Atlantean period was a period where that type of consciousness dominated the majority of the planet life. The Atlantean consciousness is not dead. It continues up until today. And some countries have it more than others, which I won't name. But you've got to understand that these, at once upon a time, these were the presiding consciousnesses. So it's still there. It's not part of history, but up to date.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's important or useful for people to understand that, because it is still present then?
It's important to understand the Atlantean consciousness, because it is the consciousness that tries to bring extensive power to the human body, to develop psychic abilities way beyond what the human being can cope with, and to increase pranic energy in the body. That's what the Atlantean, it was like the superior race. We could say that Adolf Hitler was the perfect embodiment of the Atlantean consciousness.
Uh-huh.
And the excess power that joined him was also subscribing to that Atlantean consciousness. So it's not that long ago that we experienced its attempt to rise again.
Okay. Right. All right. This student wants to know, do you, Serge, feel burdened by having access to so much knowing? And do your friends and family put demands on you to tell them about their future or their past?
I don't do any future readings. I help people in situations and indicate what may or may not happen based on the energy that is currently happening. That's how a true prophet will work. That's how a true seer works. They can allude to what is possible or very possible based on the energetic state of being that is present. And hence, if you don't change, what is said becomes very true and accurate. But the real role of telling the future is really to change it if it's not good. So by giving someone information of their present day, you can help them avoid what calamities that's going to happen. And no, there's no pressure from my family, although I help them out, and sometimes it's tough living with me because I know everything that's going on.
And do you feel burdened by that?
Not at all. I'm used to it. I'm very detached and see everything as energy and don't personalize everything or anything. And I respect that everybody's on their path and they've got their own rhythm. And there's no point asking someone to escalate or speed up their rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, this person says, I recently went to the Michael Jackson film called This Is It. So can you talk about Michael Jackson's life, a brilliant creative artist with a controversial personal life? Was he anyone notable in a previous lifetime? Now, if you can't or you choose not to talk about Michael specifically, can you give us a general understanding of a life like his, a brilliant artist with the controversial, personal, conflicted life?
Well, I hope this doesn't come across wrong, but someone like Michael Jackson, but let's step back from that. As a society, we tend to marvel at people's talents, and whether they're sporting or whether they're artistic through music, dance, poetry, painting and so forth. But we've got to understand that everything is energy, and unless you have a body of love, what you produce may be clever, may be enormously talented, as he was singing, and in this case singing and dancing and so forth, but unless you can put that together with a life of love and get that in order, then of what good is talent? Because what the message is that it's okay to be good at things, but not to have love in your body. And we've got this very, very wrong. We look at celebrities, and I treat quite a few of them over the years. I've always kept it secret, their names and so forth, as a part of privacy. I'm always on to them about what they do is not who they are. And when you take them away from what they do, they usually end up having very horrible personal lives, lives of which I know, and they wouldn't be too proud of if people would know. But they're able to then put on this costume about what they do and then be seen for that and known by that. But they often live very loveless bodies because they've been made to attain recognition and acceptance through what they do instead of who they are. And if you have a look at Michael Jackson's life, it is riddled with that factor. The fact that he was never seen for who he was, particularly by his parents. They saw him as a meal ticket. They saw him as an awesome talent. The world saw him as a talent. But they didn't see the very, very sensitive kid that still lived to the end, that couldn't handle the adult responsibilities that came with being a grown-up. I hope that doesn't sound too judgmental or critical, but we've got to stop looking at people's talents, sporting as well. The private lives of a lot of people are not a great thing to see in their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I get that. Well, we might have to make this the last question. So this student is saying, I started reading book one, your book one, the way it is, but I found it difficult to understand and, I admit, challenging. So a friend suggested I read book three, which I found much easier. And after reading book three, I went back to book one. Does it matter if I read the books in the order that you've written them?
The books are numbered in the sense of how they're written. In fact, I wrote half of book three in 2001 and didn't release it till book three. They're not in any order. Book one was deliberately released first because it was something that needed to get out there faster than anything else. Book three is definitely a lot easier. We have a sayings book, which will be very beautiful, book six. Book five is cutting-edge science and esoteric truth. And book two is a lot softer in terms of consciousness. But she doesn't have to read, or nobody needs to read them in sequence. And book one is definitely the hardest. However, once you are in the rhythm of the construct, book one is a wonderful, deeply spherical experience, which has many, many meanings. And you can read it three or four times and swear you're only reading it for the first time. It's just one of those very, very special books in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a while.
It does, and I can attest to that as well. Serge, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Heartfelt thanks for coming in this morning. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I love being able to share your wisdom with the Bay FM listeners. Now, you'll be able to come back on January 3rd, I'm so pleased, and give the Bay FM listeners a New Year's message, which we've done a couple of years before. So, any last words?
Really, just I want to say thank you to you, Gail, for making this possible. Our interviews are played on the website, and there's a cafe in the UK that plays them on loop.
Oh, really?
And they're very interesting for the people who come to the cafe. Uh-huh. It's very, very beautiful. So thank you for Bay FM and you, Gail, for the invite. And I'll be happily be back, or joyfully will be back on the 3rd.
That's great. Thanks, Serge. Now, we're going to go out with a song that Chris James wrote for Serge a few years ago, and it's called Heartfelt Thanks. That must be why I had that in my head. So thanks, Serge, and here's Chris James. Bay FM 99.9. This morning was Serge Ben-Hayen. He's the founder and director of Universal Medicine. For more information about him, you can go to his website, universalmedicine.com.au. The essence of the work that flows through Serge is in line with that which can be called sacred and esoteric by nature. It's non-traditional, following no allegiance to any cult form or belief, other than that which is found intuitively at the heart center in accordance with the spirit of the hierarchy. No claims are made other than the stance that the work, like all other before us, should always be ascertained by the individual to be the work of truth or not.
Gratitude to you. Gratitude.